Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for coming back. You're very brave. There may be some people still coming in. I don't see the hordes breaking down the doors at this point, so that's why I think we'll go ahead. Faith will be here in a few minutes. I had several people ask me for handouts, and so she's running some off now. What I've done for the handouts is simply to give you the text of all of the overheads that I project onto there. And I also have the ones from last week, if you're interested in having them from then. So today, we take up the early anti-slavery movement and societies. Last week, we talked about the background of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in Scotland and the reasons the church was so inclined to protest and resist slavery. We pointed out six significant contributions the denomination made to the anti-slavery movement. Then we looked briefly at the history and growth of African slavery in America. Today we're going to trace some of the most important steps in the late 18th and early 19th century toward ridding the United States of this scourge of slavery. This will be mostly facts today. Next time, which will be 2 weeks from today, we'll examine the doctrinal and ecclesiastical reasons behind the facts. I mentioned last week that slavery still exists, and this week came out a report, Global Slavery Report, over 40 million in slavery worldwide. And that includes people who are actually in forced labor as housekeepers or even as minors, who are sex slaves or who are sold into marriages and so on. The 40 million people in the world today still slaves. Now, the anti-slavery movement was not invented by Reformed Presbyterians. In 1701, the town of Boston proposed putting a time limit to Negroes being slaves. In other words, that they be considered indentured servants, and after they had served their, several years of indentured servitude, then they were considered to be free. Well, Boston proposed, but the legislature disposed, and the legislature did nothing. The Virginia House of Burgesses, their legislature, passed 23 acts aiming to suppress slavery and the slave trade during the colonial period, but all of those received royal vetoes. The trade was too lucrative, and if the English economy were to grow, their trades and manufacturing had to grow. Later in the 18th century, later in the 18th century, some of the churches began to have doubts about the ethics of slavery. In 1774, the Philadelphia meeting of the Quakers disowned anyone engaging in the slave trade, and in 1776, disowned any slaveholder who refused to free his slaves. This, however, applied only to the Philadelphia meeting, and it was not adopted or enforced in other parts of the country. Because of the governance structure of the Quakers, it didn't apply anywhere else. In 1794, the Presbyterian General Assembly affirmed that the biblical condemnation of man-stealers comprehends, and I quote, all who are concerned in bringing any of the human race into slavery or retaining them therein. In 1789, the General Committee of the Baptists of Virginia resolved that slavery is a violent deprivation of the rights of nature and inconsistent with Republican government, and therefore we recommend it to our brethren to make use of every measure to extirpate this horrid evil from the land. One of the rules of the Methodist discipline in 1784 was every member of our society who has slaves in his possession shall, within 12 months, legally execute and record an instrument whereby he emancipates and sets free every slave in his possession. Sounds decisive, doesn't it? But it simply didn't happen. In 1797, they came back to it and adopted a milder resolution. The preachers and other members of our society are requested to consider the subject of Negro slavery. So they didn't want to push it. You see, in all of these denominations, behavioral change was not enforced. This was in part because of the fear of losing pro-slavery members, in part, perhaps, because the members were not willing to take the financial loss and the risk of future losses. Large number of individual voices, particularly from the elite, were heard condemning slavery. Several of the founding fathers, George Washington's attitude toward slavery varied considerably across his lifetime. In a letter of 1786, he wrote that it was, quote, among my first wishes to see some plan adopted by which slavery in this country may be abolished by law. In his will, Washington provided that his slaves were to be emancipated upon his death, although by law he could not free those slaves that belonged to his wife, Martha. Remember, she had been married before, and she had inherited a number of slaves from the estate of her first husband, and Washington could not touch them. Thomas Jefferson, too, was a slaveholder, but he wrote against slavery. In his Notes on the State of Virginia, which he wrote in 1781 to 82, he described the practical moral problems raised by its existence. For example, attractive slave women were a snare and enticement to young men, which might lead to the what was called the amalgamation of the races. Young white men grew up expecting to be absolute masters in every detail of life. Nobody dared question them. And this was a disadvantage to other white people as well as to the black population. But it is noteworthy that when black slaves were customarily referred to as goods and chattels or as property or even as human cattle, Jefferson refers to them as citizens and brethren when he's writing. He wrote, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever, that considering numbers, nature, and natural means only, a revolution of the wheel of fortune, an exchange of situation, is among possible events. That is, that the black population might come to outnumber the white. The Almighty has no attribute which can take side with us in such a contest. So he places God squarely on the side of the black population. Jefferson, however, believed strongly that blacks were inferior to whites in nearly every respect, in beauty, abstract thought, and imagination, such as poetry, painting, sculpture. But he wrote that blacks are stronger in ability for physical labor, in requiring less sleep, in tolerating heat, and in not feeling or remembering their griefs and afflictions, which suggests he was kind of out of touch there, too. James Madison, the father of the Constitution, wrote, "It is wrong to admit into the Constitution the idea that there can be property in man." Similar sentiments were expressed by a number of the other founding fathers, James Monroe, Patrick Henry, Henry Clay, Senator Thomas Hart Benton, and many others. This brings us to the first RP minister in America, Reverend John Cuthbertson. Soon after the organization of the presbytery in 1774, he, and this is a quote from his diary, baptized Bess McBride, Negro. On October 17, 1780, he wrote that he had married Newport Walker and Jean Broadley, Negro mulatto. And according to the law of Pennsylvania at the time, a law which was in force at that time, he was risking a fine of £100 for doing that. Specific prohibition that any minister or justice of the peace who married a white person to a black was to be fined £100. To put that in perspective, that would be $15,586 in today's dollars. So it would have been a sizable fine. Apparently, nobody paid any attention to him. Maybe it was done in the backwoods. I don't know. A lot of the covenanters that he visited did live on the frontier and were a long ways from Philadelphia. So they probably did a lot of things that wouldn't pass muster in Philadelphia. Is that true today yet? Another black was baptized later. The scarcity of slave names among the great list of those baptized and married during his 40 years in America seemed to suggest that few, if any, among the covenanters in colonial Pennsylvania possessed slaves at that time. We should note that most of the slaves in Pennsylvania were in and around Philadelphia, and most covenanters and other Scots-Irish people were on the frontier, say, Harrisburg and west, roughly. And so they had small farms, and which they farmed themselves, and so they didn't tend to have slaves. Reverend Cuthbertson had no hesitation in administering Christian sacraments to black persons. The RPC got off to a rocky start. The presbytery had been formed in 1774, but in 1782, all the ministers and a good many members joined in a merger with the Seceders, or Associate Presbyterian Church, APs, and RPs. As with most church unions, however, the result was not one denomination, but three. Parts of both parent denominations remained independent. If you're confused about the abbreviations for that, this is what we call Presbyterian pea soup. So many denominations with P in our names. The event which precipitated a firm stand by the RPC began in November 1800. When the congregation at Coldenham, New York, called Alexander MacLeod to be their pastor. Coldenham had been reorganized in 1798, and it's officially the oldest congregation in our denomination today. And you have a picture here of their current building, the new building, which was put up in 1835. This is not the original one from 1798. MacLeod declined the call, giving as his reason that some of the people who signed the call were holders of slaves. He also preached and soon published a sermon, Negro Slavery Unjustifiable, staking out the lines of battle. And when the RP Seminary celebrated its 200th anniversary a few years ago. Here we are, yes. They put out a video, this called Negro Slavery Unjustifiable, a discourse, And they put it online. You can read the entire document online at rpts.edu/support/bicentennial series. So it's not terribly long, but it's interesting reading. He was definitely taking a stand against slavery and against racism. Oh, just a moment here. Okay. The presbytery, now having the subject regularly before them, and I'm quoting from their minutes, resolved to purge the church of this dreadful evil. They enacted that no slaveholder should be retained within their communion. In other words, you choose. Do you want to be a church member? Or do you want to be a slave owner? Make up your mind. A relatively large number of Covenanters had by this time settled in South Carolina, mostly in Chester County, which is, if you look at the map on the left of the whole state, the blue arrow is pointing to Chester County. So you can see it's in the northern part of the state, and it's in the what's called the Piedmont. It's not in the mountains, but it's not the low country either. The low country, they raised rice and indigo. The up country or back country, where Chester County is, had a little more variety in their crops. There were in all 5 congregations there, and a number of scattered societies in York County, just to the north, and in Richmond County, just to the south. Some of them owned slaves, but Reverend William King and Thomas Donnelly had been preaching about the evils of slavery for a good many years. And so not very many, comparatively speaking, not very many of the RPs there owned slaves. Well, Presbytery sent a committee of 2 ministers. Oh, and the other map, I should say, is of Chester County, and you see right in the, right in the center. There we go. Right in the center, that's Chester, the county seat. And most of the RP congregations were down here in this southeast corner of the county. Some over in Richmond County, and then there were some clear up in York County. But that's the part of South Carolina that's almost sacred ground for RPs today. Well, Presbytery, having met in New York, sent a committee of 2 ministers to South Carolina to notify them of Presbytery's action and to see that it was carried out. There were probably around 500 members in the combined congregations, and most of them freed their slaves immediately, that is, the ones who owned slaves. It's impossible to determine how many slaves were freed there. One writer of the time says that 3,000 guineas, which would be 3,150 pounds, were sacrificed on the altar of conscience. In today's money, and currency conversion is at best a guess, but the best guess by economists is that that would amount to perhaps $300,000. And so to come from 500 people, many of whom did not own slaves, that was a significant sacrifice. It might break down to about $600 per family, or 2 slaves per family, because $300 was about the market price for a black slave at that point in South Carolina. But of course, we know that many Covenanters there did not own any slaves. Reverend David S. Farris, whose father grew up in Rocky Creek congregation, later wrote, quote, "It is said that of all those who gave bonds, only four persons failed to carry out their obligations. That is, four out of however many families there were in the five congregations. One of these, James Kell, was afterwards taken in the act of adultery with his own slave. A second died a vile drunkard. And a third was reduced to abject poverty and was caught stealing the nails to make his wife's coffin. Thus the brand of Cain was put upon the sin of slavery. The blessing of God followed those that turned from their sin, and some of their children and grandchildren became ministers and elders in the church. Some of the slaves then freed also became members of the church. The committee that was sent to South Carolina accomplished two major actions. One is that, as you can see, they deposed Reverend William Martin because of two reasons. He had sold his slave rather than setting him free, and also because he was an alcoholic. He had been suspended for several years previously because of his intemperance, but then had been restored. But this time, when they sold his slave, when he sold his slave, they decided that that was a bridge too far. He had crossed a red line there. He's reported to have said to the Presbytery Committee, "You can all see that I am opposed to slavery because I've sold mine." So there was something a little skewed about his thinking at that point. Maybe his thinking came out of the bottle. I don't know. Just a few months later, then, the situation in Coldenham was resolved satisfactorily. McLeod accepted the call and was ordained and installed July 6, 1801. There was only one member of the congregation who owned any slaves. He was an elder and he owned three slaves. He set them free. The other man who had signed the call but owned slaves was not a member of the congregation. And so, the session just said, "We're not going to have anything more to do with him. He's not our responsibility." And that's, they had tried to persuade him to set his slaves free, and he wouldn't do it, so he wasn't connected with the RPC any longer. In the first edition of the church's published testimony, which was called Reformation Principles Exhibited in the Reformed Presbyterian Church in America, in the chapter on civil government, the church condemned two errors relative to slavery. They condemned as an error the statement that it is lawful for civil rulers to authorize the purchase and sale of any part of the human family as slaves. And the eighth error they condemned was that a constitution of government which deprives unoffending men of liberty and property is a moral institution to be recognized as God's ordinance. In other words, saying that the United States Constitution is not God's ordinance insofar as it recognizes slavery. Now, RPs continue to pay taxes and meet all of their civil obligations to obey the laws and so on, but they didn't feel that they were under obligation to obey those parts of the Constitution that endorsed or supported slavery. Now, it was more than just Covenanters who opposed slavery and were unhappy about it. Many people were increasingly uncomfortable because of, in the first place, the injustice of inequality. Second place, the effects on white society, which we've alluded to already. And third, the failure to live up to the Declaration of Independence. The picture you see here was a cartoon published called An Amalgamation Waltz. And you can't see much detail from very far back in here, but every couple is a black man dancing with a white woman. And this was supposed to horrify everybody. And so this was one of the arguments that people had against freeing the slaves. A series of violent slave rebellions. Oh, I'll come back to that. The solution, one of the solutions to the uncomfortable situation was to send them home, colonize them back in their, quote, homeland. Okay, there we go, slave rebellions. At first, the Reformed Presbyterian Church joined with the rest of society in being alarmed about the slave rebellions. The picture you see there is of a slave rebellion in Long Island. So it was not just confined to the South. And there were a number of slave rebellions during those years. This naturally made Southern whites uneasy. One of the solutions was tighter legal restrictions, making it illegal to teach them to read and write, for instance. Enforcing, if a black was caught traveling anywhere and didn't have a paper from his owner, he was arrested and returned to his owner. Then the next solution, which we've already hinted at, was a wish to remove slaves and free blacks from the country. At first, the RPC endorsed these plans because it seemed to be a solution. But by 1838, it was apparent that the real reason behind the American Colonization Society was to get all blacks, free as well as slave, out of the country. And it was at that point that our denomination joined the cause of abolition and said we do not support efforts at colonization, but we encourage our people to get involved with abolition groups. A number of ministers and members joined and even served as officers in the numerous anti-slavery societies that sprang up across the nation. When the American Colonization Society had been formed in 1816, their president was Bushrod Washington, who was a nephew of the president and was a Supreme Court justice. And he was kind of the figurehead for the colonization movement. There were other colonization schemes in England, Rhode Island, and Virginia, planning to send blacks to Sierra Leone and various other places. They tried to establish Liberia as a colony for freed American blacks shipped back. And, of course, Liberia, almost all of the blacks by this point had been raised in the United States. They'd grown up here. They were used to the climate and the diseases and, and so on. And they didn't know anything about Africa. They didn't want to go back there. And we can understand that. But the original plan was the assurance that all of this would be voluntary. Well, there are ways to make somebody go voluntarily. If you want to persuade them vigorously enough, you can make them decide whatever you want, right? So it was neither voluntary nor desired by the blacks themselves, and that's basically why the RP Church avoided it. By 1832, the American Colonization Society was on the ropes. And in 1836, the Synod said, the RP Church has, in fact, always been an abolition society. So putting our church squarely in the abolitionist camp rather than in the colonization camp. There were anti-slavery societies that sprang up all across the country. State Society in Pennsylvania, organized as early as 1773. By 1808, look at all the states where there were anti-slavery societies. New Jersey, Kentucky, New York, Delaware in 1809, Tennessee in 1814, Ohio and North Carolina, Maryland, Virginia. So these anti-slavery societies were springing up literally all across the United States. Okay, the American Anti-Slavery Society as a national organization was formed in 1833. By 1840, there were at least 1,454 local and state anti-slavery societies. The American Colonization Society found itself on the ropes and was reduced to making statements that would have appeared as ludicrous at the time of the Revolution. Quote, no Christian would deliberately sacrifice the substantial interests both of individuals and the community to any unsubstantial theory of the rights of man. What would Thomas Jefferson have said about that? Well, pretty much what the RPs said about it. The RPs found a number of allies in this cause. The most influential abolitionist in America was William Lloyd Garrison, who articulated three positions with which the Covenanters agreed wholeheartedly. First of all, that the U.S. Constitution was pro-slavery. This was a source of serious debate among churches and others in the United States at the time. Was this a pro-slavery document or was it not? The RPs insisted it was and had always insisted from the time of the writing of the Constitution in 1787, had insisted that, yes, the U.S. Constitution supports slavery, so it's a pro-slavery document. Garrison came along and insisted on the same thing. Christians ought not to vote in elections. And again, this was something that the RPs had insisted on since the Constitution was adopted. And finally, no union with slaveholders. We're not going to join with them in anything. We're not going to do anything that would compromise the witness against slavery. RP churches and pastors were supportive of abolition speakers and meetings, even when most other churches were afraid to because of the threat of mob violence or because of the fear of losing pro-slavery or fence-setting members. Just a few examples. In 1835, the First Congregation of Philadelphia, which met on Cherry Street at that point, hosted a rally, anti-slavery rally. They had been turned down, the people organizing it had been turned down at a number of other churches in Philadelphia. Even the Methodist churches wouldn't allow them. And so the First RP said, we'll have it at our place. George Thompson, who was a well-known English abolitionist, was the speaker. There were threats against the church, threats to burn it down. The pastor, James M. Wilson, stood beside George Thompson while he gave his lecture, lending his moral authority to the church. Nathan R. Johnston. Oops, I better keep up with myself. Nathan R. Johnston, the pastor of Topsom, Vermont, toured Vermont with Garrison. James Milligan, who was pastor at Reigate, Vermont, not very far from Topsom, escorted George Thompson on a lecture tour around New England. As a matter of fact, he bought a separate chaise, which is a kind of two-wheeled buggy, so that he could take Garrison around New England on tour. And we'll mention also the, Reverend J.R.W. Sloan, James Renick Wilson Sloan was his full name, who was pastor of Third New York. There were four RP congregations in New York City at that point. He was pastor of Third Church, and he frequently appeared on the platform with Garrison, with Wendell Phillips, and other anti-slavery speakers. One very interesting story that comes out of this period concerns Reverend James Milligan. One evening in 1834, he was on one of his frequent anti-slavery lecture tours and faced a hostile crowd. Milligan felt a personal stake in opposing the cruelties of slavery. In 1801, when he was 16 years old, he had seen a childhood friend of his who was a cook in the British Army receive 500 lashes for the crime of having flour smudged on his uniform at inspection. 500 lashes is more than enough to kill a person, even a strong person. And Milligan's friend died as a result of that beating, and Milligan vowed an enduring hatred of the whip. And so that contributed to his hatred of slavery. That was not the only reason by any means, but it inclined him against slavery. His burning anti-slavery lectures took him across New England, and this particular evening found him in an unnamed town in New Hampshire. The hostility of the audience was palpable, but he had been pelted with rotten eggs before, and so he was not deterred. He kept talking. He fearlessly denounced slavery as sin and predicted the judgment of God against the United States for this iniquity. Now voices in the audience began to murmur, "Get the tar ready." At length, a man shouted, "You've just earned yourself a coat of tar and feathers." The audience cheered. Some men removed their coats and started toward the platform. Unruffled, Milligan shouted, "Hear me out. If you'll only pay attention until the end, I'll help pay for the tar and feathers." And so the audience roared with laughter. They listened. He finished his speech. There was no further talk of tar and feathers. The next day, Milligan left town on a stagecoach and found that one of his fellow passengers was Congressman Franklin Pierce, a genial pro-slavery Democrat. "Mr. Milligan," said the congressman, "I heard your address last evening. I must say I admire your presence of mind when the issue of tar and feathers was raised. I have no doubt that you would have received the ornamental coat which you richly deserved, but you appeared too willing." And of course, Franklin Pierce was later President of the United States. Other of our ministers faced violence. William Sloan, the father of J.R.W. Sloan, faced hostility. John Black Johnston, who was a pastor in Ohio and was the founder of Geneva College, at one point was dragged from his horse and had some of his ribs broken. James Wallace, I should mention Armour McFarland, not the Armour McFarland we know and no relationship to him, but Reverend Armour McFarland from Utica, Ohio, was set upon, mobbed. James Wallace and Hugh Stevenson were set upon by a mob whose shouts could be heard 3 miles away. So the mob was angry. Alexander McLeod Milligan, who was by that point obviously named after Reverend Alexander McLeod, was minister at New Alexandria, just a few miles east of here, was rotten egged and burned in effigy in Greensburg and in the town of Elders Ridge, which is somewhere over in that area. I don't think there is an Elders Ridge town anymore. But at any rate, he suffered for that. I should mention, too, Alexander McLeod Milligan had been pastor in Vermont before he came to New Alexandria, and people named their children after ministers, and we knew of a man there, the father of Mrs. Richard Hutchison, if that means anything to any of you. His name was Alexander McLeod Milligan Macklem. And as I understand it, he was a short man, and so his name was almost longer than he was. But he was A.M.M. Milligan. Well, okay. Meanwhile, it was becoming apparent that efforts at what were called moral suasion were not moving the nation any closer to abolishing slavery. One thing that showed that is the Compromise of 1850, which was a series of five acts of Congress introduced and passed one by one, but it was a set. It involved, first of all, a reinforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act, requiring people who encountered escaping slaves to capture them and turn them back to authorities from the South or representatives of their owners. California was admitted as a free state. Texas lost territory but was compensated for it. Slave trade in the District of Columbia was outlawed, not slavery itself, but the slave trade. And New Mexico and Utah were organized as territories. Another part of that was, okay, there we go, I'm sorry. The Kansas-Nebraska Act passed in 1854, which divided a large territory into Kansas and Nebraska. And the borders of Kansas were pretty much as they are today, but the border of Nebraska went all the way from the 40th parallel, clear way up to the Canadian border at that point. But this turned out to be contentious because the principle was adopted of what's called popular sovereignty. In other words, let the people of each territory decide whether they were going to be slave or free. Now, this was contradictory to the Missouri Compromise in 1820, which had drawn a line, you know, 36 degrees and 30 seconds north of which was to be free, and south of that they could be slave. Now, this was taking it to the 40th parallel and saying, let the people decide. Then there was the Dred Scott decision in 1857, which many historians regard as absolutely the worst decision ever made by the United States Supreme Court. Dred Scott had been a slave, belonged to an officer in the U.S. Army in Missouri. Then he was taken to Illinois, which was a free state, then to Minnesota, Fort Snelling, which was a free territory, and then was taken back to Missouri when the officer was transferred back there. And he sued to be free because he had lived in a free state and a free territory. And the Supreme Court ruled, and they're just, this is almost a direct quote, African Americans were not and could not become citizens of the United States. They could become citizens of the states if the states wanted them to, but no state could make anybody a citizen of the U.S. So that was not going well, just trying to persuade the nation. So if persuasion wouldn't work, perhaps violence would. And you're familiar with the name of John Brown. On the left, you see a photograph of him at about the time of his famous rebellion. On the right, the most famous representation of him, carrying a Bible in one hand and a rifle in the other. This is from the mural in the Kansas State House, painted by a young RP fellow who had been to Geneva College, John Stuart Curry. who happens to be a relative of my wife, distantly. But this is the famous picture, and when people think about John Brown, they often have that image in their mind's eye. Well, this all quickly degenerated into a spate of deadly violence in the new territory of Kansas. There we go. I've tried to make the slides today simpler, less cluttered, more visible than they were last week, and I hope that's succeeding. In the period of 1855, roughly, to 1861, there erupted a war which the Eastern press referred to as Bleeding Kansas, and so that's the name that has stuck. The Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed in 1854. I mentioned the doctrine of popular sovereignty. In 1855, there were established two competing territorial governments. The pro-slavery territorial government was established first because a crowd of about 5,000 border ruffians came across from Missouri into Kansas. Kansas did not have good records of who lived there and who didn't. And these fellows insisted that as long as they were 10 minutes in Kansas, they were residents of Kansas and therefore entitled to vote. And so you had counties which had, say, 10 legal residents and turning in 350 votes for the pro-slavery government. And so they established their government at the town of Lecompton. Then the people who really did live in Kansas and were anti-slavery got together and established a constitution, established a free state government in Topeka. In May of 1856, an armed mob from Missouri came over and sacked the town of Lawrence, where the University of Kansas is now. And they chose Lawrence because Lawrence was kind of the hotbed of anti-slavery activity in the Kansas Territory. And so they burned, they shot, they pulled down, they generally made havoc of what had been the town of Lawrence. In response, John Brown, who lived at Osawatomie, which is south a few miles, rounded up seven pro-slavery residents and massacred them all on Pottawatomie Creek. So that's known as the Pottawatomie Massacre. Well, things kind of went downhill from there. The final act, well, I should say, too, that the sack of Lawrence in 1856 was really the first battle of the Civil War. The rest of the war didn't heat up for another 5 years, but that was definitely a battle between free state and slave state forces. After the war itself had started in 1863, William Quantrill came with a gang of Confederate irregulars, that is his militia friends, burned down most of the town of Lawrence and killed a number of citizens. I don't know whether any of you have been to the Civil War Museum in Harrisburg or not, but there's a very interesting exhibit there that shows an old revolver that actually belonged to Quantrill and was his on that raid. It was found in the dust of the street afterwards by a fellow who was looking around, and he saw the initials WQ engraved on the bottom of the handle. Well, there weren't very many WQs at that point, and so that pistol, a revolver, I should say, that he picked up is a survivor of Quantrill's raid on Lawrence. I should say, too, many of you know about the RP Church in Olathe, which isn't there anymore, but it's just south of Kansas City. And RPs that live in Olathe are part of the Shawnee congregation now. Olathe was also raided by Quantrill on his way to Lawrence. And the college where I taught for 10 years was a quarter of a mile from what had been known as the Judy Farm, a family whose last name was Judy. And Mr. Judy had been picked up by Quantrill and forced to give intelligence about who was where and so on. And then they shot him and dumped his body in the ditch there. So Quantrill's raid is memorable not only in Lawrence, but all throughout that part of eastern Kansas. Well, next time, and remember that it won't be next week because you're having communion, but we'll look at what motivated the Reformed Presbyterians in this struggle. Why were they so intransigent? It wasn't just because we're stubborn, although that's true too, but there were lots of good reasons. So, stay tuned. You should have gotten by now the handouts. Okay, one from this week and one from last week. Okay, are there any questions or comments? We've got just a few minutes, John. The Kansas forces were called Jayhawkers. And there were various names applied to the Missourians. I can't think now what the... Can you remember, Jim? Jayhawkers versus the... Anyway, and that's... The Jayhawkers is why the University of Kansas is still the Jayhawk School. And, you know, try to draw a picture of a Jayhawk. There isn't such a thing, but... you have, okay. Well, I've got a baseball cap, too. So. Yes, ma'am. That's a good question. There just were a lot of sympathizers in the North. In the first place, they didn't like the idea that the anti-slavery people, the abolitionists, were rocking the boat. They said, no, the Constitution says what it meant, and it meant what it says. And they just, you know, you're absolutely right. This was violence in the North. Now, we haven't said anything about violence in the South, but there was plenty of that, too. It's just that there were not as many RP ministers or RPs left in the South at that point. Some of them that were opposed to the anti-slavery movement were genuinely pro-slavery. And although I think by the time of the war, at least, that was a minority. And some of them, as I say, just didn't like the idea that these guys were rocking the boat. And at the time that the Civil War began, there was a great deal of discussion and disagreement about why the war was being fought. Many people in the RPs who joined the Army believed that this was a war to free the slaves, to get slavery out of the United States Constitution and out of the United States. There were other people who felt that the Civil War was fought to preserve the Union. And most of the RPs said, why fight to preserve the Union? It's not worth preserving the way it is. But we'll fight to free the slaves. And so that was why President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation produced such a negative reaction in the North. That this war was just fought to free the in, and therefore wasn't worth fighting. So it's a screwy situation, but you're absolutely right. These were in the North, in New England, and in Pennsylvania, and in Ohio, and in Indiana as well. Yeah. Well, and the history books are often wrong. Yeah, yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. Well, that reincarnation, no, we don't believe that that happens. Now, the spirit, the influence of your ancestors, there's a sense in which all of our ancestors have had an influence in shaping who we are. But that's not the same as saying that part of them is living in us. Well, you raise a very interesting point there, and we are all shaped by our ancestors in one way or another, and sometimes it seems more likely and sometimes less likely. I think of my great-grandfather Walkinshaw, who was an RP elder, a farmer in Nebraska. One of his famous sayings was, "Education only makes a man smarter in his wickedness." I don't feel that way, but I think about that regularly. That's why he didn't allow his children to go ahead with further education. My grandfather was forced to drop out of school after he finished 10th grade. On the other hand, he had a sister who became a registered nurse. So, I don't know. But it's an interesting point. Well, we have taken an hour. It is 1:30. Thank you.